From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about what would it mean to impeach Donald Trump. The constitutional scholar Joshua Matz is joining us. He's written a book with the Harvard professor Lawrence Tribe to explain how impeachment works, or how it's supposed to. In the book, they argue impeachment is not just another form of political combat. It's an emergency measurement to save the foundation of the country. So you better go into this with your eyes wide open. After this.
Want to take full control of how you give to KUER? If you're already a sustainer, you can sign up for MyKUER. You'll be able to update your contact and payment information, make changes to your monthly gift, and even leave us a message. Think of it like getting into the driver's seat. It's up to you where we go. Sign up for MyKUER at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. If you're one of those people convinced Donald Trump should be impeached for his conduct in office, you are not alone, of course. Something like 40% of the U.S. public agrees with you, believes Donald Trump should be immediately impeached. The constitutional scholars Joshua Matz and Lawrence Tribe understand the reasons you have for feeling this way, that Trump poses an existential threat to the Constitution, that he's broken down these critical norms and enumerated rights, that since he has access to the nuclear codes and sometimes behaves recklessly, he could start a war. They understand all of that. And in their new book, they themselves explore a number of potential grounds for Trump's impeachment. But what they're saying in the book to that 40% is basically, are you sure you want to do this? Are you sure you understand the stakes and the costs of impeaching a president of the United States? In the book, they worry that a large part of the American public has, as they put it, invested too much of its capacity for hope in a supposed impeachment miracle. So they explain impeachment, the history of the idea, the way the framers structured it and deliberated over it, the way it's been used or abused over time, and, of course, the price of impeachment, which they suggest may be higher than it's worth. Their book is called To End a Presidency, The Power of Impeachment. And today in the program, Joshua Matz is joining us to talk about it. He's a constitutional lawyer, the publisher of the blog Take Care, which provides legal analysis of the Trump presidency. He wrote this book, as I mentioned, along with his Harvard law professor, Lawrence Tribe. And he's joining us today from a studio in Washington, D.C. Joshua Matz, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I want to begin, I guess, with a pretty basic question. The idea for this book, did it come before Donald Trump or because of Donald Trump?
It came because of Donald Trump. It became very clear, even before Donald Trump took office, that impeachment was on the table. There was a massive swell of impeachment talk targeting both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump before the election, which was extraordinary. I mean, we've never seen an election between two non-incumbents marked by open talk of impeachment for whoever wins. Election talk then continued after Trump won the election, but before his inauguration. Yeah. Much of that was linked to his violations of the emoluments clauses. And then impeachment talk only swelled after he took office. And so it was in response both to his abuses of power and his quite disturbing conduct in his first few months in office, but also in response to this phenomena of impeachment talk overtaking American political discourse that we set out to write the book.
Now, I want to get this out of the way because you make this clear in the book that your own views, you and Professor Tribe, about Donald Trump, they're not secret. And I'm going to quote you here. You write, "We both think Trump is an abysmal president and that we're appalled by his conduct in office." And you make it clear in the book that you believe his presidency has, as you say, done damage to American democracy. But we should make it also clear that the book is not a brief about removing Trump for office. So you wanted to, I guess, make that disclaimer there that you have your own kinds of concerns about Donald Trump. But explain what you're getting at the book, because it seems like what you're saying is, look, if we're going to go through with this, we need to understand what impeachment is and exercise the proper amount of caution, I guess.
Exactly. And it would be strange to write a book about impeachment during the first couple of years of the Trump presidency and to pretend that you have no views about Trump, about his conduct in office, or about whether he should be impeached. It would be especially bizarre to do that if, like me and Professor Tribe, you're among the lawyers suing him on any number of fronts for his unlawful conduct. And so we wanted to be candid. We have a particular view of this particular president. We are not fans of his, and we think that some of what he has done could, in principle, qualify as a high crime and misdemeanor if certain facts were properly established. But the goal of the book wasn't simply to write a brief in favor of impeaching him. It was to step back in a more reflective, scholarly way and to say, okay, a lot of people want to impeach him. What does that mean?
Yeah.
Why do they want to do it? What would the implications really be? Would it backfire in perhaps really spectacular ways? The book really reflects an exercise in sort of even-keeled, clear-headed thinking that tries to think systematically and historically about this widely shared sentiment in American politics.
You say in the book that a lot of the time people come up with this Roman Colosseum style of impeachment analysis. It's something you're not a fan of. Explain what you're hearing, what you mean by that. And when you hear people talking about their own analyses of impeachment, what the makeup of that is.
We borrow the Roman Colosseum idea. I mean, you probably have, of course, heard the historical tales. You know, gladiators would do combat in the Colosseum, and someone would win, someone would lose. And depending on how the crowd as a whole responded and how whoever was presiding over it felt, there would be a thumbs up or a thumbs down. You know, thumbs up, the person lives. And that conception of impeachment, you know, where there's a question, did the president commit a high crime and misdemeanor? Yes or no? That is the only question that matters. And if you say yes, then you better get rid of the president today. And if no, then everything is just hokey-dory. That just seems to us like a very unsatisfactory way of approaching the question. But it's also the way in which we think a lot of people do. And I'm sure you've seen hundreds of articles written in that style. You know, Madison thought X was bad.
Yeah.
The president has done X.
Yeah.
Therefore, the president must be impeached. And that's the whole analysis. That's the whole discussion. And we wrote our book against that very narrow way of conceptualizing the stakes of an impeachment.
You know what interested me, too, was what – and you go through this broad history of impeachment talk, as you put it. It turns out we do this a lot. Talk a little bit about that if you would – we'll get into the real deep history in a moment. But the way we've talked historically about impeaching presidents we don't like, we've always done it in some ways, but it seems like we're doing it even more in this modern era.
That's exactly right. I think a lot of people know the stories of Andrew Johnson and Richard Nixon and Bill Clinton. Those are the stories that anchor a lot of popular understanding about impeachment. And I think it's common for people to think that that's it, that that really exhausts the subject. And so one of the things we do in Chapter 5 of the book is offer a much fuller history of efforts to impeach the president in the House and in the Senate, as well as popular discourse about impeachment. And it turns out you find some really amazing stories, you know, calls to impeach Thomas Jefferson for deliberate neglect in failing to appoint a collector of the Port of Boston,
right.
Calls to impeach Truman over his decision to fire General Douglas MacArthur, battles over impeachment when President Woodrow Wilson comes back and wants to join the League of Nations. So there is a history of impeachment being mobilized in national politics. But what we've seen over the past 25 years is a stark departure from that. You know, we trace the rise of what we call the permanent presidential impeachment campaign to the late years of the Clinton presidency, which is also, not coincidentally, when a lot of our national politics started to go off the rails and enter the world of what we now think of as broken politics. And we show how ever since Clinton, impeachment isn't treated as this extraordinary measure that you use only at times of the clearest national crisis to talk about restraining or ending a presidency. and it has instead become a run-of-the-mill weapon of partisan war that people reach to almost automatically mm-hmm. when they disagree with the president or disapprove of what he's done. And one of the points we make, and I'm sure we may talk about this later, is that the sort of massive saturation of national politics with impeachment talk has actually weakened the impeachment power as a check on the president and exacerbated some of the underlying tensions that are breaking our political system in the first place.
It's interesting. Up until that Clinton era, as you mentioned, we could be pretty proud of ourselves as a country that we acted with so much restraint. I mean, we should point out we've never actually impeached or removed a president of the United States. It's never happened.
It's never happened. I mean, there were a few efforts. I mean, obviously, there was an effort to impeach President Tyler in the antebellum period, in which where the Whigs in Congress thought he was a bit too trigger happy in using his veto pen. There was the effort to impeach Andrew Johnson after the Civil War for impeding Reconstruction. That failed by a single vote in the Senate. There was the effort to impeach Nixon. And then, of course, as you mentioned, then there came the effort to impeach Clinton, which really changed the dynamic. It's kind of amazing because it's not like American political history is a story of tea parties and hugs where people just love the president and everything is great and we're all getting along. There have been brutal moments in our political history where the impeachment power was not weaponized and was not brought to bear. And by and large, we think that's a good thing because of its extraordinary potential to destabilize our constitutional system.
I was interested in this before we jump into the history. You say that a lot of the things that you cover in the book, you know, about the way the impeachment power has been shaped and, in fact, has shaped our own political system, legal systems, that has received, as you put it, shockingly little attention. Explain what you mean by that and why you think that is.
Well, let me answer the second question first. It turns out that historically, most writing about impeachment occurs either when an impeachment is about to start, during an impeachment, or when people really hate the president and they're out to get him. And it may not come as a surprise that that context has perhaps lent itself to advocacy and, frankly, hackery more than it has even-handed reflection on the power. Because these works have not been produced for the sake of general public understanding. They've been produced to either support or oppose a particular impeachment effort. And I think when you approach the question that way, as merely a means to the end of achieving a purely political or partisan objective, you've gone awry at the very outset. And so what ends up happening is that a lot of the existing works on the subject answer very narrow questions, much closer to what we talked about as being the Roman Colosseum style. Mm-hmm. You know, you get these endless lists of could this be impeachable? Could that be impeachable? And obviously the lists are always a thinly veiled subterfuge for something the president recently did or didn't do.
Right.
And, you know, and then it's like, oh, well, that's impeachable. How do we know? Well, Madison wrote something on a napkin that sounds kind of like that. And so we can infer that it must have been meant to be impeachable. And what you miss is this broader understanding of the role that impeachment has played in shaping our politics and changes in broader popular and political understanding of what impeachment is for. And now that we live in this world of a permanent presidential impeachment campaign, which I think there's every reason to believe will continue indefinitely unless something changes, we need to take more seriously what it's like to live in a world, in a reality, where calls to impeach the president are a workaday part of our politics instead of the last of all last possible resorts.
You say what you want out of the book is the possibility that it might serve as a basis for bipartisan discussions. And I know that's a tall order given the things you just mentioned. I mean, we're in a hyper-partisan era right now. But just say a little bit more about that, what you hope for the book, beyond the broad understanding of the history of all of this and how it works, but that people might be able to have discussions about the stakes, I suppose, and what this means.
I think, you know, David Frum, writing in The Atlantic, described our book as a kind of political aspirin to cool a national headache on the subject. It's sort of weird, you know, to on the, a lot of the books on the subject have been aimed, like we said, at impeaching a particular president or achieving a particular end. Our goal in writing this book was to change the way people think about the subject, not with an eye to any particular outcome in this presidency or a future presidency, because goodness only knows what our system will look like in 5 years or 10 or 20.
Yeah.
And we want this to be a book that you can pick up in 20 years and use just as much as you could use it today. And so our goal is to offer a comprehensive framework of all of the questions that you would want to answer in deciding whether it's a good idea to talk about impeachment and whether it's a good idea to try to pursue an impeachment. And if you do decide to pursue an impeachment, we try to identify the key questions that you would want to ask in thinking about how to do that in a way that's likely to pull the country together rather than ripping it apart. And with respect to each of those questions, we offer a framework. You know, here are the things you should think about. Here's what matters. You know, here's what the framers did decide for us. And then here, most of it, is what they didn't. And that's where we need to exercise good judgment. And here's how you might start thinking about how to do that.
Okay. When we get back from a break, we'll jump in. Joshua Matz is with us. His book, written along with the Harvard Law professor Lawrence Tribe, is called To End a Presidency, The Power of Impeachment. We'll take a break. Be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West from KUER.
Benjamin Franklin said, "Tell me and I forget. Teach me and I may remember. Involve me and I learn." That sums up KUER's community calendar pretty well. You'll learn new things, like how to make your own honey, or write a story, or arrange flowers. There are new events every week, and if you've got something you want to show people, you can post your own events too. Check out the community calendar under the events tab at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're asking, what does it mean to impeach Donald Trump or any president? The constitutional scholar Joshua Matz is joining us. He's written a book along with the Harvard professor Lawrence Tribe to explain how impeachment works or how it's supposed to work. And in the book, they argue impeachment is not just another form of political combat. They say it's an emergency measure meant to save the foundation of the country. So you need to go into this with your eyes wide open. The book is To End a Presidency, The Power of Impeachment. Joshua Matz is joining us from a studio in Washington, D.C. One of the things that you're careful about is what you call misty-eyed framer worship. You don't like to think that this impeachment process is just following the wisdom set out in, you know, the Constitution, that holy parchment. Explain that as just sort of the grounds before we jump into this. That, I mean, and we'll talk about the deliberations, but the idea of the Constitution being holy parchment and perfectly understanding this, that's one of those myths I think you deal with in the book.
Absolutely. You know, and there we're responding to some recent writing that really trends in the direction of what we call framer worship. The main problem we have with that way of approaching it is that it isn't actually faithful to the original understanding or to the framers' design. This is one of the great powers of the Constitution. It goes to the very heart of the system of checks and balances, to the system that secures our freedom. The framers made some very important choices. They said that you can't impeach just because you don't like his policies. You need high crimes and misdemeanors. And they said, you know, we're going to decide who impeaches. It's going to be the House will have to vote articles of impeachment, and then a supermajority of the Senate will have to convict on them. They established the consequences for an impeachment, that you lose your office, but unless you're otherwise disqualified from holding office again, you don't lose anything else. You don't face capital punishment,
right,
for example. And they decided who could be impeached, civil officers of the United States, including the president. We need to respect the decisions they made. But it's one thing to do that, and it's quite another to pretend that they somehow magically looked out over centuries, a period of time in which many features of American life changed, including how we pick the president, the role of the vice president, the manner in which we elect the Senate, the emergence of political parties, and so much else. you know, and to insist that they made very specific decisions back in 1789 about whether particular conduct in 2018 is impeachable and would make it wise and prudent and appropriate for the political process to move toward impeachment. And so one of the main goals of the book was to emphasize that we have responsibility here. Originalism in this area is often a way of denying responsibility. Madison made this choice for us. Hamilton did. And that's just not true. We need to accept that this is a power that was given to us and that the framers delegated to the future the most important decisions about where it is appropriate and prudent to exercise.
When the framers got together to craft a constitution in 1787, was it clear that there was going to be something like impeachment?
Not at all. I mean, the Articles of Confederation didn't include anything like that because there wasn't really an executive worthy of the name.
Right.
When the framers set about designing the presidency, there were a lot of unanswered questions. Will there be one chief executive or several? How often will they be elected? Can they be removed from office? What powers will they have? What do we even call the position? I mean, they didn't arrive at president until pretty late in the Constitutional Convention. And in thinking about whether to include a means of removing the president, there was a real debate that stretched out over a period of months. Many framers understood intuitively that you can't create this newly powerful federal government with an energetic chief executive and deny the nation an escape hatch if something goes awry.
Right.
As Benjamin Franklin put it, if we don't allow for impeachment, the only alternative is going to be assassination. And world history was pretty consistent on that point.
Right.
That the history of failed rulers was a history of coups and revolutions and assassinations and invasions. A majority of the framers recognized that they needed an out. And so they reached for this ancient English parliamentary prerogative of impeachment, which kind of ironically had mostly died on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean by the time that they incorporated it, but which, like some other, you know, elements of English law and practice, had found new root in America and had been assimilated into the colonists' understanding of their powers and as Englishmen.
Yeah.
And so the framers take this idea of impeachment. They Americanize it in a whole lot of ways that make it look very different than anything in England or in Europe. And they put it there on a divided vote. They put it there because they realized that it could doom the republic if the president goes rogue and there's nothing that can be done about it.
How did impeachment work? You mentioned that it dates back to 1376, but I'm trying to imagine how it worked in a system that was an absolute monarchy. How did it work, impeachment?
Oh, poorly.
Yeah, right.
And what ended up happening is the creation of this fiction. And the English were very good at these sorts of legal fictions, especially in the 1600s and 1700s, as Parliament started asserting power over the crown, where they would say, well, we can't impeach a ruler who has the divine right to be the king. But what we can do is impeach all of his senior advisors and ministers, because, you know, if the monarch has done something really terrible, that must be because his evil ministers have led him astray. And it turns out that if you can exercise the impeachment power around all of the people advising the king and executing the king's vision, you can get pretty far in asserting some degree of control over the king. And that was the trajectory of impeachment in the 1600s, in the late 1600s in England. But ultimately, there wasn't much of a need for that because there were other major changes in English political life that obviated the need for such a crude tool for Parliament to exercise control. On this side of the Atlantic, the impeachment power really took off around the Revolution.
Right.
As colonists had this insightful idea that they were going to start impeaching crown counselors and judges. And it came as a bit of a surprise to British officials here, and understandably so, because the colonists, as a formal legal matter, had no right to impeach anyone for anything. But the colonists were nothing if not precocious in laying claim to these powers, and they simply started exercising it and saw what happened. And as it turns out, things went well enough that they decided to write it into the federal constitution too.
So they agree that the country needs impeachment. And then we get to the question of how they structure it and how they limit it. But would you say something about de Tocqueville first? It's interesting that Alexis de Tocqueville wrote about impeachment. In fact, you say he wrote a whole chapter about it.
He did. In Democracy in America, which is one of those great books, you know, so great that to this day we still inflict it on undergraduate freshmen and expect them to divine some of its wisdom.
Yeah.
He includes this whole chapter on impeachment, and he's fascinated by it because he shows up here and he says, we have something called impeachment in Europe. It looks nothing like this. Mm. And he was intrigued, you know, because he said, you've imposed all these limits on it. In Europe, parliaments could impeach anybody, private citizens, crown counselors, really everyone except the king. They could hold any kind of trial they wanted. They could impeach for anything they wanted. And they could impose any sentence they wanted, including death. And they did.
Yeah.
And he gets here and he looks at this Americanized impeachment power and says, this is weird. They've imposed these limits on it, the ones that I've already talked about who can exercise it and who can be impeached and what the consequences are. And he concludes that was really smart because it turns out that if the impeachment power can go off the rails the way it could in Europe, parliaments would be afraid of exercising it. But here, impeachment, as he put it, was such a temperate remedy for political wrongdoing that it would be readily available. There would be no hesitation about impeaching. And he thought that impeachment would become a regular fixture of American political life. Now, it turns out he was wrong.
Right.
And, you know, as it turns out, even famous people whose books we still read from hundreds of years ago are wrong sometimes. And wrong in an interesting way, because he had predictions about how the constitutional separation of powers would work that didn't pan out. But he was really intrigued by the creativeness with which Americans linked this ancient parliamentary power to the necessities of a democratic system with checks and balances, where you needed to restrain the president, but you also didn't want Congress to wield impeachment in a way that would allow it to club the president into submission.
Hmm. You mentioned some of the limits that they placed on this power of impeachment. I wanted to mention another one in particular. And this is the rule of wrongdoing, that you have to have proof of treason, of bribery, or of other high crimes and misdemeanors. You have to have proof. And on this point, you write, presidents cannot be removed from office on the sole basis of poor judgment, of general inadequacy, of perceived incapacity, or of strong policy disagreements. Let's talk a little bit about this particular point, because I think there's some confusion about what exactly is a high crime and a misdemeanor? What exactly does that mean? How much of this is a subjective impression? How much of this is a legal analysis? Because I'm not sure that's clear to a lot of people.
Well, and fairly so, because it isn't clear.
Yeah, right.
And your question, you know, what exactly is a high crime and a misdemeanor? I mean, boy, I could not answer that.
Yeah.
You know, and we devote the entirety of Chapter 2 of our book to that. And if you're interested, I would say go read that, because that will answer it far better than I could possibly do in just a couple minutes here. And parenthetically, I would emphasize the fact that a high crime and misdemeanor may have been committed, of course, doesn't mandate impeachment. It simply makes impeachment a permissible response under the Constitution. But when we're talking about high crimes and misdemeanors, we're in the realm of serious wrongdoing by the president, ordinarily involving an abuse of presidential power that poses a genuine threat to the nation's constitutional system and makes the president unviable as the leader of a democratic society going forward. So we're in the realm of very serious wrongdoing. I mean, look at that list: treason, bribery, and other high crimes and misdemeanors. You know, usually when you have a list like that with a vague catch-all phrase at the end, you interpret that last phrase as being of the same kind as the earlier things on the list. You know, when you talk about treason, a betrayal of the nation of the highest order, or bribery, corruption, selling out the nation's interest to advance your own private gain, you're talking about forms of presidential malfeasance from which the nation might well struggle to recover.
Yeah.
And that's really what you need, something that threatens the constitutional order as opposed to a disagreement over the wisdom of a particular policy.
Yeah. It's interesting. I keep hearing these arguments that you were mentioning. You hear all kinds of arguments these days about impeachment. And I keep hearing that impeachment is, in fact, not a legal remedy. It's a political one. But I'm not sure that's true after reading the book. It seems like it's in between in some ways.
That's exactly right. It's sort of a strange alchemy where you're in the realm of something that feels law-like, where you're governed by the Constitution. It provides a standard that looks like a legal standard that has been assimilated by our nation's people. You know, when you say to the American public, we should impeach him for high crimes and misdemeanors, many of them will ask, where are the high crimes and misdemeanors? Mm-hmm. That feels like a legal question. And if the president is impeached in the House, there's a trial in the Senate, which is very legalistic. There are lawyers all over this, as we've now seen with President Trump's legal team. At the same time, the ultimate judgment was given by the framers to Congress. They thought about other people. They thought about giving it to the Supreme Court. They thought about giving it to the Supreme Court and the Senate sitting together. I mean, while they were at it, they thought about giving it to a council of the state legislatures, a council of state governors, and a committee of the chief justice of the highest court of every state. So they turned over all the rocks. They also created some new rocks and turned them over too. But they ultimately decided to give it to Congress. And Congress is by its nature a political body. And even if it will sit in an adjudicative capacity, these are politicians we're talking about. And so as much as impeachment has these legal elements, the ultimate decision maker is a political body, and it will care about and respond to political concerns, and rightly so. Yeah. Because the question whether a particular offense or particular conduct justifies removing the president from office can't really be answered in the abstract. When you say, will this conduct imperil the political system or the constitutional system, that includes as much political judgment as it does legal. And then when you say, is removing someone from office worth the price we may pay when they've committed that conduct, that question too is irreducibly political. So there are elements of both. And when people pretend that one or the other element doesn't exist, right, either that it's all law and politics has nothing to do with it, or it's all politics and there's nothing outside of that, they're presenting a really mistaken conception of what's happening here.
But do you think it was a mistake to give it to the legislature? Because you say in the book that the framers expected us to see shades of gray in our concerns about presidents. But if you give it to the legislative branch, to the power of impeachment, there are so many political dimensions that could come into play here. And we're seeing it now, obviously, and maybe a lack of restraint, more hyper-partisanship. Do you see that in any way? And you and Professor Tribe, did you see that in any way a flaw?
Well, look, I'm the last person on earth who wants to go on radio and tell everyone about how great Congress is and how we can trust it to responsibly exercise its powers. But you have to ask yourself, who else would do this? The framers thought a lot about it. You know, the other alternative championed by Madison himself was the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
But look at Bush versus Gore.
Right.
I don't think anyone views that as an example of the wisdom of putting the Supreme Court in control over who holds the office of the presidency. And it really isn't clear if the Supreme Court has the raw institutional legitimacy and capacity to remove a president from office or not to. I mean, imagine if the House of Representatives, speaking on behalf of the entire people of the nation, leveled articles of impeachment against the president and the Supreme Court, possibly including some appointees by that very president, refused to end the presidency. That would be a constitutional crisis of the first magnitude. So the difficulty here is that there aren't a lot of good options. And the framers didn't pick Congress because they thought it would always be fabulous. They were well aware that Congress had its flaws, and in particular that the House of Representatives would have its problems. They just concluded that there was nobody else that they could put in charge of this.
Yeah. And that it was important to have it. So Congress
that it was important to have it.
Yeah.
Exactly. And they understood that there was a political dimension.
Right.
You needed someone to do this who could credibly claim to act on behalf of the nation. Because keep in mind, and I think this is clear, let's imagine President Trump is someday impeached. And let's imagine that you could muster the votes in the Senate necessary to convict. I would be surprised if there weren't at least 10 to 20 million people. And let's be candid, some of them heavily armed and quite skeptical of the government in general, who would view what had just happened as a coup. Giving this power to the political branches can confer it with a kind of legitimacy that it would really be hard to get anywhere else. And it also gives it to a branch that's capable of thinking panoramically and systematically about the ultimate consequences of an impeachment and of responding to it in real time.
I want to get to some of these. In the book, you explore what you call these unhealthy dynamics that have weakened democracy in this country and make the case about impeachment all that more complicated. And I want to compare two experiences that you write about in the book, one from two very different times. The attempt to impeach John Tyler in 1842, I think that's instructive. And compare that to Bill Clinton 156 years later. First of all, let's talk about the case of John Tyler. You referred to it a little bit earlier. Tyler becomes president really unexpectedly. William Henry Harrison dies just a month into his presidency. And he runs on the Whig ticket, Tyler does, with Harrison. But he's not really a Whig. And this is a problem. Talk a little bit about how this story plays out, because I want to compare it to modern times.
Gladly. So Tyler comes to power, and as you've described, he's not really a Whig. He's not on board with their major national platform for infrastructure and tariffs. And these questions of national economic development were really the great questions of the time and the issue that most divided the parties. And so he comes into office and shows really no reluctance about vetoing almost everything coming out of the Whig Congress. He makes their lives an absolute nightmare. And Whig leaders in the House just can't deal with it. It blows their minds. They get angrier and angrier. And finally, they just reach a point where they say, you know what? We're going to just make him veto bill after bill after bill. Right. And we're going to start building an impeachment case on the theory that he is abusively exercising his veto power. You know, and so they commission one of the committees in the House to write a report describing describing the grounds for impeachment. And the president himself was astonished. You know, he writes at the time, he says, I can't believe it. You can't impeach me purely on the basis of this policy disagreement. That's preposterous. It would completely destabilize the system. And frankly, it looks historically like the Whigs might well have forged ahead if they hadn't ended up suffering crushing defeats in the midterm elections that year and losing control of the legislature. And that's ultimately what ended up saving the president. Although even after that, you know, he was so unpopular that virtually everyone he nominated for any position was rejected. Yeah. And he was checked and balanced into virtual irrelevance for the remainder of his time in office. And so that was a case where impeachment was obviously not justified, and there was no national political appetite for it. And what ended up happening instead is that other checks and balances came to the fore and put him in his place at a time where he was out of step with what Congress wanted.
Now, fast forward to Bill Clinton, because you say that the Tyler example, of course, is one of those examples of how impeachment should not be used. But it doesn't seem like we learned the lesson of Tyler with the Bill Clinton story. So where are you putting that in the context of history?
Well, the connection we draw between those two impeachments is that they were both partisan in character, that there wasn't clear national support in either case for removing the president from office. And that doing so would not have been properly justified. Now, there is an important distinction to draw, which is that President Tyler did not commit high crimes and misdemeanors in the manner in which he exercised the veto power. There is a compelling argument that President Clinton might well have committed high crimes and misdemeanors when he committed perjury and obstruction, allegedly, in the Starr investigation. And in fact, some Democrats in the Senate said, we do believe he's committed high crimes and misdemeanors. We just don't think that those are sufficient to justify removing him from office.
Right.
But in both cases, what the commonality, notwithstanding that distinction, is that the impeachment was and was widely seen as partisan and failed for that very reason, that in neither case was there a clear, durable, bipartisan national consensus that the president had done something so wrong that he had to be removed from office immediately.
In the book, I mentioned some of those unhealthy dynamics that you're worried about. And I wanted to tease out a few of the points that you make in the book. And this will resonate with people, that Republicans generally see Democrats as closed-minded and immoral and lazy, and Democrats believe similar things of Republicans, that they're immoral and also unintelligent. And the upshot, you say in the book, is that partisan affiliation has become, or I'll quote you here, increasingly central to a personal social relationship and to personal identity. And that seems like the unique function here, that seems different in some ways. We're so hyper-partisan that we've connected now our political ideological views into our personal identity. Would you talk about that?
Happily. And that discussion occurs in Chapter 6 of the book, where the basic question we're trying to answer is whether the impeachment power can achieve its basic function in the modern world of broken politics. Because it's not obvious that it can. This is a power that requires a supermajority support in the Senate, and therefore that requires the ability on the part of the American people to generate some degree of political consensus and to engage in political deliberation. And in that respect, we emphasize the impeachment clause is not a tripwire that will just automatically spring to life in cases of presidential wrongdoing that imperil the nation. It's really better understood as a wager, a gamble, that the American people will recognize and rally against tyranny. And one of the things that can prevent that from happening is a breakdown in the fabric of our democratic system. And so in Chapter 6, we chart any number of trends in campaign finance, in partisan gerrymandering, in our information environments, but most especially, as you've picked up on, in the degree to which people comprehend partisanship and politics as part of their lives and make judgments about other people and about themselves by reference to that. You know, the way we put it is that in 2018, the political is personal. You know, we live in a time in which people are quick to view those who disagree with them as the enemy, in which tribalism is on the march in a way that leads people to excuse outrageous conduct within their own ranks, even as they go apoplectic at the sign of even minor wrongdoing in the other.
Yeah.
And those dynamics can really impede the kind of democratic deliberation that's essential for the impeachment power to function as intended.
Well, you write, bipartisanship consensus has become little more than a mirage these days. And this has led to, you say, a diminishing faith in democracy. So I'm wondering what that means, this lack of faith, if we all have a lack of faith in the system now, which seems to be the case. How does that affect the way we think about impeachment? And can we really even be any more objective about all of this?
Well, I don't know if we ever could be objective. I don't know what objective maybe means in this context.
Yeah.
But the consequences can cut in a lot of directions. So there's a ton of evidence that younger Americans report lower rates of commitment to democracy, higher levels of willingness to live in non-democratic systems, that they're skeptical that democracy is the best form of government. And there's been this now several month period where there's a new book every week with varying forms of how democracy ends, how democracies die, the end of democracy, et cetera, et cetera.
I think that's the title of one of them, actually, but keep going. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's many books that have versions of the words death and democracy together.
Yeah.
And for good reason, because it's a real crisis in our political system if people are losing faith in the democratic system and in having a democracy at all. Now, in the context of an impeachment, that can cut in a bunch of different ways. It might make people more open to undemocratic uses of presidential power because they're less concerned with the idea that the president's conduct may undermine premises of a political system that they're less committed to. At the same time, it might make impeaching more important. Because at a time in which faith in democracy is eroding, presidential conduct that chips away at democracy is all the more menacing and nefarious. And so the terrible tragedy of our moment is that the desire to defend democracy from presidential conduct that imperils it may be at its weakest precisely when it needs to be at its strongest. And one of the questions that we identify, but you know, we don't have an answer to because it's a really hard question, is what do you do in that circumstance. And you can ask that question at a very general level, like how do you save democracy? How do you rehabilitate faith in the system? That's beyond the scope of our book. You can also ask, how should it affect your thinking about impeachment? Should you be more or less inclined to impeach a president at a time of diminished faith in democracy when impeachment has the potential to save the democratic system and to stop norm-destructive behavior, but also at a time when the impeachment process itself, as we saw under Nixon, can weaken people's faith in democracy by airing its dirtiest laundry in the most open way and exposing a profound failure of the system?
You understand for a lot of Americans right now is kind of a scary moment, as you put it. But you say you worry that a large portion of the country, as I said in the introduction, this came from your book, that the country's invested too much of this in this impeachment miracle. And you say that this kind of thinking, that impeachment is going to save us from you know, Donald Trump, has concrete harms. And one of the things you say about that is that this mindset relegates, as you say, most citizens to the sidelines. Talk a little bit about that, that this idea that there's impeachment that's going to save us keeps Americans from actually engaging in the other dynamics of the democratic process, I guess.
This relates directly to what we've just been talking about, that we live at a time where there are threats to the democratic system, and we don't know the answer to how you fix that, but we're really sure that part of it is a broad-based citizen engagement with the democratic system at all levels of government, running for office, getting politically engaged, investing in these issues and caring about them. Impeachment, though, is often described as this far-off small player drama, right? It's Robert Mueller and his team and Rosenstein and a few people in the House and the president and their lawyers. And it's just something that's way outside the immediate control of the vast number of people. You know, if you're committed to impeachment, there's just not a lot that you can wake up and do on a daily basis to make that happen. And when you come to think that the gravity of the situation is so extreme that the only thing that's worth caring about, the only thing that can save it is impeachment, that can be disempowering. It can be paralyzing. And more importantly, it's wrong. That at a time in which you think that the system has gone off the rails, even if you think that, you know, almost all of it is attributable to President Trump, which in my view it isn't, if you think that that's the case, there's a lot you can do at many other levels of government and in your own communities to help rehabilitate the system. Because at the end of the day, impeachment is only possible if you can generate a robust national political consensus in favor of the view that the president has gone off the rails and needs to be restrained.
Yeah.
And generating that consensus doesn't necessarily involve impeachment talk. I've actually found that raising impeachment at the beginning of a conversation can alienate people a lot more than it invites them to engage in a dialogue. And so when you think, you know, something really terrible has happened, the only thing I can do is tweet about impeachment all day. I think that that is not only isolating and disempowering, but it's also a strategically mistaken response to the situation.
I should mention that you lay out what you see as several potential grounds for impeachment on the part of Donald Trump: abuse of the pardon power, obstruction of justice, failure to protect the nation from foreign interference and cyber attack, possible conspiracy with foreign power. So you make that case, but you also write that you're not persuaded, and this was when you sort of locked the book down in mid-March. You said, as of that time, you didn't believe Donald Trump had manifested an inability in the relevant sense of the term. And I'm wondering if anything had changed since March, if you still are of that mind, because you talk about how believing that there might be a potential case there is the beginning of the story, as you put it, not the end.
Sure. It sounds like you might be describing two different parts of the book. So in one part of the book, at the end of chapter two, we walk through the various alleged impeachable offenses committed by President Trump. We conclude that at least as to four of them, abuse of the pardon power, possible conspiracy with foreign powers to influence the election, obstruction of justice, and kleptocracy, including his emoluments violations, that at least with respect to those four, should the facts necessary to substantiate a case emerge, that might well, in principle, justify exercise of the impeachment power. Now, that's a different question than whether that will happen, whether the political will emerge, whether it will be wise, but whether that constitutional floor is met, whether there's a high crime and misdemeanor. We think those four things are the kinds of things that would count if the relevant facts all come in and support it. And I think the jury's still out on a lot of those facts. We also, in Chapter 6, talk about the 25th Amendment. And that's where the idea of inability and incapacity comes into play that I think you may have been referring to.
Yeah.
And there we describe in some detail how the 25th Amendment works, why it was set up that way, historical discussions of it. And then we go into all of these various questions about President Trump's mental health and mental capacity. And we concluded at the time that we finished the book in very early 2018 that there wasn't a sufficient basis for concluding that he was objectively unable to exercise the powers and duties of his office. And I continue to remain of that view, that the 25th Amendment was not built for cases of someone who lacks the temperament or fitness or judgment to serve as the president, all of which I believe are true of Mr. Trump. But was instead built for people who really just can't exercise the powers, people who've been kidnapped or who are in a coma or who have had severe mental degeneration or a psychotic break. I mean, you're in the realm of I literally can't be president. And we emphasize there that efforts to use the 25th Amendment to political ends are unlikely to backfire because there you not only need half the House and a supermajority of the Senate like you do for the impeachment power. You actually need the vice president, most of the cabinet, and then a supermajority of both the House and the Senate on a continuing basis because the president gets to continually challenge whether he's actually incapacitated. And so to the extent you're talking about, you know, the political odds of ending a presidency one way or another, the 25th Amendment is no sane person's bet.
Right. That's Joshua Matz. He, along with Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Tribe, co-wrote the book To End a Presidency, The Power of Impeachment. Joshua joined us today from a studio in Washington, D.C. Joshua Matz, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, technical direction from Tim Slover, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.